This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The story of Noah's Ark has a life that extends far beyond the pages of the Bible. Images of animals walking two by two are ubiquitous on baby toys and decorative items. And the character Noah appears often in pop culture. I mean, take, for instance, the film Evan Almighty. But one North Carolina author began to wonder why most of these recurring images of Noah's Ark were cheerful and optimistic. She'd always thought of the story as a narrative about the destruction of the world. She was even more struck by the fact that while we certainly talk about Noah, nobody seems to think twice about Noah's wife and family, who more or less blindly followed him aboard the Ark. Both of these ideas now serve as the premise for Lindsay Stark's debut novel, Noah's Wife. Lindsay's a PhD candidate at UNC's Comparative Literature Department. She's going to be reading from her novel at a variety of venues in coming weeks. But first, she joins me in the studio. Lindsay Stark, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's so nice to be here.
Tell us more about this portrayal of the flood and kind of what you noticed and what brought you to this story.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, this is a story about the destruction of the world. And when we see it in popular culture, the animals marching two by two, the baby toys with the rainbows, the puzzles, the baby shower invitations, it seems a lot lighter than it actually is. So I was very interested in exploring some of those darker themes, including, disappointment, doubt, and destruction.
And the relationships that were involved that don't get played up so much. They are two by two, but we don't go into sort of how those relationships, particularly the families.
Exactly. I mean, it's a story. I see my novel as a story about pairings, the way the Noah story is about pairings, but instead of animals, here it's husbands and wives, mothers and daughters, friends and neighbors. It's really a study of relationships.
Friends and neighbors and their communities and sort of how those pairings add up to something that we would call a community.
Yeah, it's also a story of it's a small town, beleaguered. It's been raining for as long as anyone can remember. And the story looks at who stays and who leaves, who sticks it out, what are the bonds that hold community together, and what dissolves community.
So tell us about Noah and his wife.
Well, Noah has a secret struggle. He's having an internal crisis of faith that no one really recognizes.
Because he's a minister.
He's a minister, yes. He comes to this small town to revitalize the church, but he needs some revitalization himself. His wife, who is very comfortable in her role as Noah's wife, she's never named. She likes being defined by the stronger characters in her life. She will journey over the course of the novel from being a marginal figure, a minor character, to a protagonist.
Maybe I can get you to read for us from your novel.
I'd love to. This is just a short passage from the prologue, which is one of the few chapters that remained unchanged through many years of edits. and it's really, it sets the scene of the town, and it's about the rain. So, from the prologue. The water pours down roofs and rushes through gutters and falls in silver arcs from the eaves to the ground. It collects between the cracks in the sidewalk and then spreads in pools across the pavement. The townspeople postpone school picnics and town parades, put away their bicycles, carve ditches through their lawns, take baseball bats to knock rust from their cars. They purchase special light boxes from a mail-order catalog because the description promises that the bulbs will cheer them by simulating the sun. They collect ponchos and rain boots and wear them with self-conscious style. They learn how to walk two abreast on the sidewalk while carrying open umbrellas. The trick is in the tilt, a slight movement of the elbow toward the side of one's body so that the spokes do not collide. How lovely the streets look with the color of all the umbrellas, says Mrs. McGinn to her neighbors with a fierce and dogged optimism. How pleasant it is not to have to water our lawns or wash our cars.
That is author Lindsay Stark reading from her debut novel, Noah's Wife. She's going to be reading at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight at 7 o'clock and Scuppernong Books in Greensboro tomorrow at 3. And we have more at our website, stateofthings.org. So there you set it up in the prologue. Everybody is sort of going to bear up. They're going to put on their bed, do their best to make the best of a bad situation. But it keeps getting bad. And now it tests the faith and the patience of the people in town. Things start to fall apart.
Yes, they do. And fairly quickly.
And I'm going to ask you maybe to give us a kind of sketch of some of the menagerie of characters who are this town, who sort of trellis this piece and hold it all together in a way.
Sure. Well, I figured that since I was writing a story about a minor character, Noah's wife, who becomes a protagonist, I should populate the novel with a lot of other strong minor characters who sometimes take over the story. The novel is divided into 40 short chapters, each one from a distinct perspective, and sometimes Noah's wife doesn't even appear in those chapters. Mrs. McGinn is the town matriarch. She's trying to hold everything together. She's a very strong figure. There's Mauro, the Italian expatriate who just wants to go home. There's Liesl, the organist who doesn't believe in pairing off, who prefers to be on her own. There's a zookeeper, a misanthropic zookeeper who, the first line we hear about him is he doesn't like animals very much at all, but he likes people even less. So he's a zookeeper.
So it's a great ensemble of characters who do make up this town. And as you say, a minister in a crisis of faith and the dutiful minister's wife who plays that role and realizes that as the anxieties grow and as the tensions mount, things fall apart and she begins to fill in and take a larger role, though she remains unnamed in your novel.
Yes, she finally has to act for one of the first times in her life. And in this town, she has the opportunity to learn things about herself. When the famous zoo floods and the townspeople have to take animals into their homes, provides a little comic relief from those darker themes I mentioned, she learns that she's really good with animals, and Noah is terrible with them. He keeps getting bitten and scratched.
And the zookeeper hates them. So again, people also sort of discovering their true identities, smashing through the structures of community, the structures of faith, all of the things that, you know, we tend to have a kind of magical thinking about these things. You can imagine a prophet coming up with the notion of the divine, and then within a couple of generations, people think, you know, if we keep doing the same thing over and over again, we'll keep having these same blessings, and then the blessings stop, and everybody questions the whole structure, right? And that seems to be where we are when this novel begins.
Yes, it is. And the novel, it's all about change, too. I've always had a great fear and anxiety about change. My characters have that, too, somehow. So they're worried about the fact that the world is going to look different than it did, and they don't know how to cope.
Particularly when you've trusted these structures to get you through, and they're just not working. And so, and then their personal identities and how those identities either bear up and rise to the occasion or don't, and you come into your full personhood vis-a-vis these decayed structures. I think it's a wonderful thing. But and interestingly enough, I understand that this book began for you, or you thought about this book in terms of historical fiction at first. Am I right?
Yeah, the first chapter I wrote as a historical novel, I suppose, set in the desert of biblical times that I imagined. But then I didn't want to do any research, so I transferred it to the contemporary day, where it turned out I still needed to do research. But there it was more interesting. It wasn't so much about historical meals and desert voyages.
Well, you'd have to find out what the heck a cubit is.
Exactly. And I still have no idea.
No, it's, so. I don't know. But it takes a lot of them to make an arc. I'll tell you that.
I've heard that.
It's too bad, though, that you didn't do it, because any time I talk about Noah's Ark on this program, I have one question for anybody who has ever thought about Noah's Ark. And I know you didn't do the historical research, but it's been nagging me since the first time I read the story. It's two of every animal, and we know why. But worms are hermaphrodites. So my question is, did Noah need two worms on the ark?
This is a good question.
Yeah.
Will we ever know? Maybe my next novel, I could explore it.
Maybe you could. I tell you what, let me ask. Yes, I insist that you have the answer the next time you come back.
Okay.
Because nobody has been able to answer it for me. Mrs. McGinn, you talked a little bit about her. Maybe remind us, because I'd like you to read another section that highlights her personality.
Sure. Mrs. McGinn is, yeah, a very strong matriarch. She's so strong that the characters who surround her in her life are named through her. So Mrs. McGinn's daughter is another minor character, as is Mrs. McGinn's husband. And one of the struggles of Mrs. McGinn's daughter is to find a place and a name for herself beyond the orbit of her mother, that very powerful star. So, yes, I actually have a passage I could read from Mrs. McGinn's daughter's perspective, speaking with the zookeeper, her fiancé. This is from chapter 4. Oh, the one thing you should know about Mrs. McGinn is she's been through four husbands, so that has shaped her daughter. Mrs. McGinn's daughter takes great pleasure in feeding the penguins. They are exotic, comically formal, and monogamous. At the tank, she remarks upon this fact, and her hard face softens, her eyes warming to her favorite subject. Tell me the others, she insists, dipping a hand again into her pail. You know, the animals who mate for life. Gibbons, swans, bald eagles, the zookeeper says automatically, rattling off the list that he has rattled off 100 times before. Wolves, termites, beavers, pigeons, prions. Prairie voles, black vultures, she continues. Her tongue trips lightly over the names, and her tone rises and falls as if in song. That's right, he says. He doesn't mind these pointed reminders of hers. As the daughter of a revolving set of fathers, perhaps it is only to be expected that she find comfort in stories of successful relationships and in the knowledge that the animal world is not completely devoid of constancy. There is such a thing, he is slowly training her to believe, as fidelity.
Lindsay Stark reading from her debut novel, Noah's Wife. She'll be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight, and then she's going to be in Greensboro at Scuppernong Books tomorrow at 3. I've often wondered, and I love to ask this question of authors about these wonderful moments for the reader as the themes begin to emerge when you do the job you did of sort of creating this tension between structures that worked for a while and now we have to reinvent them. And we have to reinvent ourselves through the structure, like it or not, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that's not working. And so then you give us this image of this zoo, presumably somewhere in the United States, that has penguins. They don't belong here. They're formal. They're natural, but they don't belong here. They're clearly out of place. And that's, you know, the way it reinforces the theme is wonderful. And I just wonder how intentional you are about a thing like that, or if that's just, of course, it's a zoo and the penguins would be a funny picture.
Mm-hmm. No, very intentional. I think a lot about sort of the choices and the themes while I'm writing. I might be a little too theme-driven at times. But yeah, I mean, the story is about people who feel out of place. Noah's wife, who comes to this community, she's not a part of. Mauro, the expatriate, who isn't a part of it. Women as outsiders in general in this town and community. And I did try to draw some parallels between animals and humans. There are moments when humans take on animal qualities. In the passage I just read, the zookeeper is thinking of training his fiance to think a certain way. At other points, characters will say to each other, well, we're not the same as animals. Here's how we're different. But they, too, they feel snared. They feel trapped. The rain is this net that's holding them in town. And so there are a lot of similarities between them.
You said you didn't have to do biblical research once you dropped the idea of a historical novel. But you did research on what?
On zoos, actually. I didn't know very much about animals. I grew up with a cat, and I have a dog now, but that's about as far as it goes. So I actually visited the North Carolina Zoo in Asheboro and was taken behind the scenes by the director there, Ken, and it was fantastic. I saw animals being fed. I learned that, you know, crickets stay in cardboard egg cartons, so you'll see in my novel, that's there. I spoke to some zookeepers who were friends of friends, and they told me animal stories, this one about a flamingo who really hated tall girls and would always attack tall girls when she saw them. So stories that I have about my animals came from places like that.
Well, what's the best story that couldn't make it into the book that we could only know now because you're here?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, this isn't a story, but one thing I learned at the zoo, which unfortunately is completely the opposite of my story, is that humans and animals shouldn't spend a lot of humans and wild animals shouldn't spend a lot of time in close proximity to each other. The director of the Asheboro Zoo, it's a very beautiful place, and he really believes in giving the animals the space they need and letting them be sort of as wild as possible in this domestic environment. And my animals are not very wild. They're in bathtubs, they're in garages, there's a sick cheetah who is getting fed through chicken wire. It's whimsical, let's say. It's not that realistic, even though the research does serve as a kind of foundation.
No, but it does point to another theme that emerges through your book, and that is this question of what is wild and what is domestic, and how does domestication, you know, sort of have an effect on us? You get used to a particular way of being domesticated. If those systems don't work for you anymore, if the master isn't going to put out the milk for you the way they did, you got to find a new way to eat.
Yeah, certainly.
And so this is a bit of a surprise for you, I understand, because this began as your sort of MFA project, and now it's published by a major publisher, and here you are on tour.
Yeah, it's still very surreal to see the book sitting out on tables. But yeah, it was a very literary, slow, character-driven novel. We didn't expect it to be purchased by a big commercial house. But it was. The editor liked the characters and the voice. The only problem was that once she bought it, I needed 5 years to actually give it a story, some tension, some rise and fall. So it's been a very long process.
Wait, tell us about some of that process. What were some of the big changes, if there were sort of fundamental changes that you had to make along the way?
Well, as I mentioned, there wasn't a whole lot of tension. I like to write about characters, and I think the first draft of the novel could best be described as a lot of charming characters wandering around talking to each other in the rain, and that was about it. Mm-hmm. So we needed a little more tension. We needed a little more rising action. And fortunately, as my editor pointed out, I always had that in the rain, which was a backdrop but becomes, in subsequent versions, more of a character. The rain intensifies, and I use that to kind of derive the tension in relationships, which is also intensifying as the rain does.
That would be something I would think you would have to learn how to do, how to take something that is, you know, not human and create it and make it a character. We often talk about the place as a character, and now you talk about rain as a character. As a young writer, I'm guessing that's something that you'd have to really work at to make that happen.
Yes, I did. It's been a long, as I mentioned, 5 or 6 years, a lot of tears, a lot of cursing. It took me a while to get where I am.
You're currently working on your PhD in comparative literature, and I wonder how being interested in both the creative and the critical aspects of literature inform your work. Do you want to write more? Do you want to do more novels?
Yes, I do. I would like to write more novels. I'd like to write more criticism. I think the best critics are the creative thinkers, and I think the most interesting novelists for me are the ones who've thought very critically about what they're doing and why. And I really like, you can tell from the story, I really like books that engage with other books and the way stories are told and retold across generations and geographies.
Does this 5-year process of yours give you any new insights or thoughts about the original story, Noah's Ark?
Yeah, well, what I wanted to do with that story, and I think it does. I mean, the short answer to your question is yes. I think the best adaptation should help us reconsider the original. And I wanted to think about the people who were left behind. This is a town that's been forgotten, the way that I imagined the people left in the rain as the Ark sailed away were forgotten. And they wonder, in a sense, what they've done wrong. And I think I've begun to consider more the human themes of the story instead of just the divine, and I hope my novel does that for readers.
And it's an interesting story, too. It's been with us for a long time, and obviously the Bible is something that stayed in print for a long time, but we're not familiar with all of the stories. There's a lot in it that doesn't make its way to our children's pajamas.
Right.
And so I wonder if you've thought about why this story in particular has loomed as large as it has in our imaginations.
Well, I think we see flood stories in all kinds of cultures and ancient mythologies. It comes up more than once. And I think we like stories about animals, some of the ones that remain. Daniel in the lion's den, I hear about a lot. Adam naming the animals in the Garden of Eden. We like animal stories, and we like rainbows and doves and hope. And there's a lot of that at the end of the flood story after the world's been
washed away.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a story about redemption. There's good news at the end of that. You know, it's bad for a minute, but then, 40 days or so. No, it's a great story, except for the lingering question about the lowly worm.
Right, which I'm going to get on as soon as I leave the studio.
I hope so. Well, thank you very much. Otherwise, it's a fine book, even though you left out that detail. Lindsay Stark is talking about her new novel and the debut novel, Noah's Wife. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lindsay's going to launch her book at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight at 7 o'clock, and she'll be in Greensboro at Scuppernong Books tomorrow at 3, many other venues around the area in coming weeks, and you can find out about them at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, jazz trumpeter Al Strong shares his songs from a new solo album, live on the State of Things. Stay with us.